Hey, Whiskey Ringers, welcome to a brand new intro. First off, there are still a few bottles of our barrel, single barrel rye, finished in Armagnac casks, picked in partnership with This Is My Bourbon podcast. Check out the show notes for links to purchase. Second, I am thrilled to announce that I've joined the Bar Cart Co-op. This group of podcasts and shows has a show or multiple for everyone. I'll talk more about them in the mid-roll. Finally, there are still two $25 spots available on Patreon. These are the last two spots that will ever be open on that tier, so if you've been putting it off, grab your spot today. There are also spots available at the $15 a month level if you want to support, but can't quite commit to that $25 tier just yet. There's a spot in supporting for everyone's budget, and I truly thank you all for making this podcast possible. Hey, folks, welcome to a special bonus episode of the Whiskey Ring Podcast. Today, I'm welcoming you back Ari Sussman. You've heard him on podcasts about Mammoth Rye, about Whiskey Gypsy's first expression journey. And today we have him back on to talk about the next release, Explorer. This is a straight bourbon whiskey finished with French and Appalachian oak staves, or Appalachian oak staves. I'll pronounce it all the ways just to make sure I've covered everything. But today he's here to talk again about the expression, what went into it, and the, I don't know, any other questions that may come up. So Ari, welcome back on.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's great to see you again.
Same here. All right. So this is the, as you said, the second expression. It's a straight bourbon whiskey. And the big draw of this one that we're putting forward is that you've got the two wood components, one, the Appalachian oak, and then French oak, specifically from the Tronchet forest. Am I pronouncing that, or is it Tronchet?
I say Tronchet, but my French accent is really bad. So Tronchet is the Midwesterner way of pronouncing it.
That's right. I just noticed the little squiggle at the bottom of the C, and I was like, oh, it's probably a S. So I want to start off with this with the wood. Is normally we would start off with the whiskey that's inside it, and we'll talk about that a little bit as well. But I really wanted to talk about the wood here because that's the star, I think. You've done something very unique and different with this, in that you're taking two disparate oak species to forests, really. One geographically designated in France, one that's not geographically designated in the US, but is specific to a particular region, this being North Carolina, near where Eric Church grew up, who's a partner in this project. And it's, I don't know, I've just always had an affinity for talking about wood species and how different woods can affect it. So let's just start from the beginning of what gave the idea that this was going to be the follow-up to the journey.
Great question. So from the very beginning of Outsider Spirits, we decided that we're going to do some explorations. And that was the word that we originally used, even before we decided to call this Explorer. We're going to do some explorations of concepts in whiskey and with legacy, with the journey, with the first one that we tried. That's a whiskey blend. That's a cross-category whiskey blend. So we're blending a bourbon, a 20-year-old Canadian rye, and an American single malt. And we're looking to have some fun with blending. And you might be interested in knowing that we have another one, another legacy in the works, which is another international blended product. It's cross-category. Three different countries are represented, and all of the components are over 10 years old. It's pretty remarkable.
Nice.
And we knew that we wanted to play with cross-category whiskey blending as sort of an ultra premium expression. But wood finishing, which has become a trend over the past couple years, it's pretty ubiquitous. Many companies do wood finishing. We knew that we wanted to create a product that would be more accessible. So at a good approachable proof, all of our Explorer whiskeys, this is the first one, but we have several in process, are between 103 and 107 proof. And we began years ago finishing whiskeys with all types of woods from around the world, woods that have been used not just in spirits, but in wine, in perfumery, and other applications as well. So I think just in general, the whiskey community is only beginning to scratch the surface of the characteristics that can go into a whiskey through by using wood, and not only understanding the species of wood and where it's grown, but also how it's cured or aged, and how it's either toasted or charred. These are all sort of levers that whiskey makers and coopers have of modifying the characteristic of a whiskey. So international cross-category whiskey blending, no borders, no rules. That's one. Using really high quality, I mentioned proof. Also, no whiskeys under 6 year old in the Explorer line. So 6 year old or older, over 100 proof, and then finished with woods around the world. And hopefully woods that don't just taste and smell compelling and delicious. That's table stakes. But hopefully are sort of portals into telling stories about the cultures and the agricultures from where those woods come. And in the best case scenario, those stories tie into the brand and the sort of reason that the brand exists and the reasons why we're you know, on shelves and in glasses. There is a third sort of whiskey skew that we will be releasing in the future, and that has more to do with agriculture and the grain itself, and that'll come later. So really, at the end of the day, there's sort of three parallel expressions between and this is the inaugural batch of the second. So lots of fun things in the works.
Awesome. And I do want to note, as we're getting into this, I'll post pictures of this as the episode goes live. The media kit for this product is really impressive. So comes in, I almost consider it like it's a wood box, but it's opens up like book wood. It kind of reminds me of Indiana Jones type thing you might find. And then you open it, you've got three pages on the different oaks. So the American oak, the French oak, and then how the whiskey and wood interact. Of course, a sample of the product, but then also two cutouts. I'm holding it with the camera now, which doesn't make any sense, but just do it anyway. Two cutouts of wood, one from the American white oak and one from the Transay French oak. And in looking at them side by side, I think they've lost a little bit of their scent at this point because I've had it open for a while. But I don't know, actually, no, I'm still there a little bit. But when you open it for the first time, the scent is definitely there. You can smell the difference in the two woods. Yeah. And I think the smell hit me before even looking at the look of them. But it was a fascinating study because you can look at a cross-section of wood of the tree, the same type that you have. You can see the green, you can see the growth patterns, the striations throughout it. And so obviously as a fortunate member of the whiskey media, I got to see this kind of sample set. And I was curious if you had any plans to include this kind of thing for the regular release as maybe like a gift box or deluxe box, something like that.
There aren't really plans of doing that, but the response that we've gotten from these media kits has been pretty strong, pretty overwhelming. I think people are impressed by it. Like you, this is the media kit that you can not just try the whiskey, but you're learning about where each of the components come from. And you can hold them in your hand and you can smell them, you know, and you can go back. And the more senses we can incorporate into showing someone what a whiskey can be or what we hope a whiskey can be, I think the better. So we do try to engage the intellect as well as the nose and the fingers. We want you to touch and hold and smell and taste and learn. And you know, I think we talked about this last time I was here, that whiskey is just it's a fantastic palette for expressing ideas and for sharing ideas. A media kit like this is very much intended to do just that.
Oh, look, like I said, I really enjoyed it. And what's important to remember too is, look, I have tasted the whiskey. I do happen to really, really like it. I think it's one of my favorite expressions using French oak in particular. And probably because it's using virgin French oak. So as much as I do like French oak in general, my whiskeys, brand new French oak, just nobody's doing it. Number one, there's only one other company, which I mentioned to you offline, that I know is using virgin French oak for American whiskeys. And everything else is, maybe it's a wine cask or it's been used something else. So you still get the French oak characteristics, but it's muted. It's a little diluted because it's been used. But seeing it and smelling it in particular, frankly, smelling the wood, I could imagine this being so fragrant. And we think of French oak as more, as opposed to American oak, which is kind of coconutty, buttery, baking spice, a lot of vanillin from the lignans. The French oak, there's elements of that, but it's a little smokier, perfumey in particular. You can imagine this having kind of cloves and those spicier baking spices, as opposed to the warm cinnamon, you get a spicy clove in there. And by smelling it alone, which we don't get to do very often as whiskey drinkers, you can really understand what it's supposed to be. And I take that as an important thing. I'm going off on a tangent here, but I take it as an important thing for intentionality. Because if someone says they're finishing their whiskey in French oak, like, you want to taste the French oak. You don't want it to overwhelm the whiskey, but you want to taste the French oak. Same thing if they finish it in a port barrel or Sauternes or any of the crazy, you know, brandy finishes we've seen. And what I was wondering as I was nosing it and tasting it, if a particular note may have come from one word or the other, I had these two in my hand to be like, oh, this smells more like it's probably from this or from that. So I think I don't want to, you know, discount the American Appalachian Forest white oak, because that is a big component of it. But I think people listening to the podcast may be more familiar with that as a category. Although there are, of course, nuances of it being from North Carolina in that particular area. But I want to focus a lot on the French oak just because it's much different in this case. So you're ideating the product. You're thinking, okay, we want to test out a couple of different woods. Want to use one wood from where Eric Church is from in North Carolina, and then the other one with the French. So the first question just being, why French for this particular release? And then the back part of that is, well, let's start with the French for this particular reason. The second question is a longer one, so I'll add that later.
All right. Well, okay, that's a great question. First of all, thank you. It means a lot to us to hear that you like the product. Not just, you know, it's one thing to have cool marketing materials. It's another thing entirely to have a liquid that people enjoy. And so thank you. It's great to hear that. Imagine a blending table or a whiskey laboratory full of bottles of either individual whiskeys or blends of whiskeys that we've been working on for some time. We're looking to see how different whiskeys interact with each other, and which whiskeys coming together can sort of improve upon the entire whiskey as a whole. This whiskey actually started with the whiskey blend. I know that you wanted to hold off and talk about the wood first, but it actually started with the whiskey blend and blending a sweet Kentucky bourbon with a high rye Indiana bourbon. And in such a proportion that both the sweetness and the spice were preserved. And those two whiskeys coming together ended up having about a 30% rye, if you were to extrapolate the mash bill. It started as a whiskey that we felt was really interesting, that it had the components that we look for in a sweet bourbon, as well as the components that we look for, the spicier components in high rye. And I thought about how to accentuate each of those characteristics. And to accentuate the sweetness of the Kentucky bourbon, we selected Appalachian oak because of its characteristic. It turns out that there's this really, that Eric Church was like, yeah, that's comes from really close to where I grew up. I know this forest. That's some wood that I've had experience with, and it lends that you mentioned sort of a buttery sweetness and a caramel character. That comes from the toasted Appalachian oak. And I should say that we toasted those staves ourselves. We did toast those ones over some of them over a campfire at Eric's farm, where we had some barrels that we were decommissioning. So we built a fire and then had some really fantastic North Carolina staves. And we'll be posting some videos about that. You'll see it soon enough. But imagine a big bonfire on a farm, and we're out there toasting and charring staves ourselves that end up in the whiskey. But for the high rye component of the whiskey blend, to accentuate that, there were a couple of options that were on the table. I'm a huge fan of Hungarian oak. Done well, there's other ways of accentuating spice. Obviously, there's South American woods that accentuate spice in really interesting ways. So there were about four or five woods that we're trying to figure out which is the right wood to match with the Appalachian sweetness, to accentuate the sweetness of this, or the spiciness of the whiskey. And it's really the smokiness and the clove character that you mentioned, these wonderful aromatics that drew us to Trancé, to the Trancé forest. I was really happy that sensory panels and running samples through the team kind of led in that direction, because I am personally a huge fan of this is a little bit of an aside. I love wines from Bordeaux. I was a winemaker before I was a whiskey maker. Learning about wine production in Bordeaux and how different varietals of wines are blended together, for even the most elite, some of the most expressive and elite wines in the world. I'd always thought that what they do with blending wine in Bordeaux could be translated to the whiskey world. That they understand that these different wines have these different characteristics that go really well together. And that's part of the ethos of what we're doing, blend whiskeys. And in Bordeaux, many of the top wine houses use oak exclusively from the Trancé forest. Those are big wines, and they require an expressive cask. And so that's what led us to selecting the Trancé oak. When we started looking into the history of the Trancé forest, this other story, or actually a number of stories, began emerging about that area that we felt also tied into the brand and some of the things that we were getting at. For instance, Eric, one of the co-founders of the brand, along with Raj Alva, Eric very much comes from this sort of troubadour tradition, this traveling musician tradition, which obviously has found fertile ground in the Appalachian Mountains. This is where a lot of American folk music and country music comes from, and that can be traced back in many ways to Scotland and Ireland. But the troubadour tradition, this idea that the poets with instruments that you can carry, who would sing songs of the heart and put their feelings to poetry, which we take for granted now is like music, right? But that very much starts in France 800 or so years ago. And the Trancé forest is one of those physical places from which the troubadour tradition arises. The early troubadours were all over the Trancé. Later we learned that the person in charge of Trancé was the Duke of Bordeaux, or sorry, the Duke of Bourbon, where bourbon comes from, the name bourbon comes from. So now there's another connection, because Trancé was run by the Duke of Bourbon. So we thought it would be really interesting to make a bourbon with using ingredients from that forest. And then there's so much history in this region. So the oak stands that were originally planted by Louis XIV, he was growing trees so that he could build essentially warships for the French Navy. The descendants of those initial trees became the raw ingredient for the casks of places like Bordeaux. So the very trees that we're looking, you know, that are in your box, that are in this whiskey, you know, were planted, their ancestors were planted for the French Navy. And it just, it tied together some really fascinating stories. And that's one of the things we love about whiskey, that it starts these conversations and it can send you down wormholes of learning and trying to find ways of connecting the past, hopefully connecting the past with the present. And that's one of the things that we think whiskey can do.
And just to tie that in as well, I think I've told this story on the podcast before, but certainly not in a while, that, you know, when I was studying medieval history, my thesis was on English oak management, 1247 to 1447. And it was focused specifically on royal-owned forests, and they defined forest as an area as opposed to what we think of today as the definition of forest, a grouping of trees. It's, you know, you could have a forest that had areas where there were no trees, where it was hunting grounds. And, that's really what it was in England, just as it was in France. These were forests where, yes, they were growing trees for these purposes, especially for navies, because all these countries with great navies needed a lot of oak and strong oak at that. Think of Spain, of Portugal, Britain, France. These are all countries that have very, not only strong oak traditions, but at this point have oak stands named after them. Hungary, not so much. It's a little more landlocked, but that's different. But when I was studying it, the thing that kept coming out was, even, you know, as you said, 800 years ago, and there's a very strong connection between the British and the French at that point, and the English or the French, I should say, they were both thinking about how to manage these forests. They knew that in order to make a strong ship, you needed wood that had grown for a very long time, was very straight, was very, a lot of things we look for a barrel, just on a larger scale. It was straight. It was watertight. No knots for leakage. You know, you look at the side of even a painting of a ship or a picture of a ship, there are no knots in the outer wood planks because it would just leak. And it's the same idea with a barrel. So these forests are being managed very tightly. There are huge numbers of records in England about these forests. Not as much in France, just because they burned a lot of them in the French Revolution. I think Spain also, they lost a lot in that revolution. So Britain's one of the few places where you could still get those kinds of long-term records. And of course, they're all in French and Latin until the 1700s. But this is all to get to the point of France has been very protective of their forests. They've got five, they have many forests, but they have five in particular that are kind of this royal five, the big five, Troncé being one of them. So I'm curious to know the story of how to get oak from that, like what the process is involved to get oak from Troncé, and how the, you know, did you have to interact with the French government in that sense, or was that kind of taken care of? And yeah, I'd just love to hear about that process.
Oh yeah, sourcing oak is seems to be an art form in and of itself. We live now in an age of wood brokers, and there are people that specialize in this. And in general, in France in particular, brands like ours don't have to deal directly with the French government. We deal with wood brokers and cooperages, who oftentimes will certainly sell barrels, but can also sell staves that barrels can be constructed of. Because there are a number of cooperages in the world that buy staves from all over the world and sometimes assemble these, sometimes intentionally, sometimes less so. They build barrels from staves from either wherever they can get them, or specialty barrels from staves from very specific regions. So we've made contacts with all kinds of oak brokers and wood brokers in general. But the, like everything else in this industry, whether it's the business or the law or the history, everything becomes a sort of a interesting rabbit hole full of unique individuals with big personalities, and sourcing wood. I wait for someone to write a book about some of these brokers, these barrel brokers that are traveling the world supplying not only American whiskey makers, but whiskey makers around the world with high quality oak. I wish more of them would keep blogs, because yep, the stories that we hear about the places they visit are incredible. They're sort of There are a number of people who are roving around the world looking for pallets of staves so that they can bring them to the United States and have coopers make specialty casks for people. And sometimes you can have access to those staves before they go into a barrel. This is another issue that distillers are dealing with, which is consumers love barrel-aged product, but barrels are sometimes a fantastic vessel for imparting character, but sometimes when you're just looking to tightly control the character that's being extracted from the wood, staves are a better option. And staves, like any raw ingredient, if you have a raw stave, you can toast it, you can char it, you can toast it to all kinds of different levels. Ages ago, not ages ago, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, companies like the Independent Stave Company, which is a large cooperage in the United States, used to have these symposia, and they would publish books, and wood experts from all over the world would come together. These are hard books to find. You can maybe find some on eBay, the ISC annual. Somehow I had about five of these different books end up on my shelf, and I ended up going through them, and they identify forests and toast levels and how to toast wood from certain forests to achieve higher levels of vanillin. I don't exactly know how applicable they all are at this point, if they're out of date, but they get you thinking about mechanisms of experimentation. And so we used a lot of these old Independent Stave Company books, as well as working with wood brokers to in convection ovens, because you can toast your own wood. You don't need someone else to do it for you. To try to pull out these flavors and try to expand the spectrum or the palette of aromas and flavors that we whiskey makers have access to.
It's a book that needs writing for sure. And I'm reading right now, this is related, but I'm reading right now Cask Management for Distillers by Matt Strickland.
Matt Strickland?
Yeah. And it's obviously an industry-facing book. It's not for the casual whiskey drinker or the casual reader, but it's fascinating because it's including the chemical chains and the different esterifications that happen, and it gives you certainly a sense of what, if you're entering distilling and in maturation and you've never touched a cask before and you're looking at what to, you know, where to buy a cask, what to look for in a cask, how to water tested, make sure it's airtight or watertight at least, that you could read this book. That's not really that long, honestly. It's very much meant as a primer for them. But
there's a second book, the two books that kind of, I think, work really well together are Matt Strickland's books. And I think basically all distillers should read all of Matt Strickland's writings, whether it's LinkedIn posts or published materials. He is not only a uniquely thoughtful whiskey maker, but he's almost singularly generous with his information. He shares it widely with anybody that's willing to listen. That's rare, and it's to be applauded. But the second book that I oftentimes give folks that I work with, in addition to the one that you mentioned by Matt Strickland, is Hubert Germain Rabin wrote a book about cask maturation as well. And that's really fascinating because it brings in a whole different maturation tradition, primarily around cognac and brandies. And these two bodies of knowledge, I think, can be synthesized and work together in interesting ways.
For sure. And Germain Rabin has come up only in passing on podcast a couple of times, mainly really when, for example, talking to some of the earliest craft distillers in the U.S. We're talking about Clear Creek and Hood River out in Oregon. I mean, Germain Rabin, Clear Creek, Hood River, and probably St. George are maybe the three earliest craft distilleries in the U.S. Arguably there's one or two others that I'm sure I'm forgetting that I'll get a call about or an email about, but I looked at those three. I mean, and Germain Rabin, to your point, is known still more for the brandy, the liqueurs. They have a great absinthe, I should say, white absinthe. that makes a great Sazerac, but they don't get as much attention, I think, because it's not in the whiskey realm and people aren't paying enough attention yet to American brandies. So you, if you know Germaine Robin, you know they're good quality, but not everyone knows them quite yet.
And it's been acquired by Gallo, right? His distillery was acquired by Gallo.
I didn't even know that.
Oh yeah, they're actually doing fantastic work, and oftentimes when a large company buys someone who's been such a sort of pillar of quality and integrity, you're like, oh man, I hope they don't screw this up. But I think Gallo's actually done a really phenomenal job, and the Germaine Robin products are fantastic. They remain fantastic, and they're not. They're resisting the urge to release more products at a younger age to just capitalize on the name. They have proper maturation going on. And again, they deserve to be applauded. Distillers should absolutely be looking at barrel management for brandy makers. It would be silly not to.
Absolutely. And especially as we're getting into not just the initial cask, you know, if we're talking about American whiskey, it has to be the new charred oak. Unless it's with a few exceptions, obviously, for categories. But for the main part, it has to be new charred oak, at least to start with. But with cask finishing remaining for the foreseeable future, a trend that I think will continue, I agree. It behooves both distillers and, frankly, whiskey drinkers who are interested to read some of these books or start out on some of the articles by Strickland and by others to get a sense of what they're drinking. Is there are certain woods that we've kind of seen as fads, if you will. So I think of, I mean, obviously Ambarana was like 2023. Everyone did an Ambarana finish. Personally, I really couldn't stand it. It was too strong, but I know there are people who loved it. Then Tokai went through a little bit of a period. I've got, obviously, the Toasted Oak has gone on for a couple of years. You can look back to, Michter's Toast, all of their barrels. No matter what, but they also added the toasting as a finish. But, and then there's a period where a couple of companies, which shall remain nameless, just kind of went hog wild with the idea of doing whatever finish you wanted to do. So let's focus a little bit more on the French oak, which is notable for its structure as well. So to introduce that, I guess we'll talk just briefly about the white oak, American white oak. So the American white oak, you're looking at a very slow growth, tighter grain to it, and obviously different chemicals and compounds in it that are going to react differently to both alcohol and water in different solubilities and different chemical reactions. We're more familiar with the American oak, but for the French oak, what does that look like? Is it tighter, looser grain, allow for more oxidization versus kind of cask maturation? What do you look at for that?
So you had mentioned structure. This French oak is looser grain. It's actually Appalachian oak that we chose has a tight grain indicative of being sort of grown closer to the top of a mountain. And you get a lot of these are things that cooperages and wood managers and forest managers, they're measuring everything to the millimeter to figure out exactly, the tighter the grain, the more compounds are there. It's kind of like a concentrate, really, relative to some of the Ambarana, for instance, is such a loose wood grown in a warm climate. They leak like sieves. They're just very difficult to get tight. One thing I'll say about Ambarana, it's kind of like fish sauce, where a little bit goes a long way. You can overdo fish sauce in a dish, but if you just put the right amount in and maybe use it in combination with other things, now you're kind of thinking more like a chef, as opposed to I'll take a whiskey and put this one wood in it. Ambarana and a lot of woods kind of work really well in concert with other woods, which was kind of one of the concepts that we wanted to really push on here, which is that woods can work together. So the French oak has this remarkable structure. The structure It has a physical structure, right, of the wood itself. What I love about it is the spice and the tannin. The tannin provides structure in your mouth. And tannins are both soluble in ethanol and water, but they're more soluble in ethanol. So you're going to extract tannins very quickly in something like a 105 proof alcohol solution. Wood sugars, on the other hand, sugars in general, are not soluble in ethanol. They're soluble in water, right? So if you had two glasses in front of you, and one was water and one was like neutral grain spirit at 95%, at 190 proof, and you just took table sugar and you poured an equal amount in both and came back the next morning, the water glass, the sugar would be dissolved. You wouldn't see any. But the sugar at the bottom of the glass of neutral grain spirit would look like you just poured it. It wouldn't dissolve at all. So the extraction rates of sweetness and the extraction rates of tannin happen at different rates, mm-hmm. which is why, from a production point of view, first we blend, and this is a little bit in the weeds on the production side. First we blend the whiskey itself, put it in non-reactive vessels, stainless steel tanks, sometimes polyethylene tanks. And once we have wood that's been either, you know, toasted to the right specification or not, we'll, even though the whiskey is equivalent around all the toasts, we won't put the same, or we won't put different woods in the same tote. I want to just put American oak in one tote, French oak in another tote. And however large the batch is, want to be able to taste each tote, and then when it's time on a very regular basis to see how the product is coming along, we'll make blends. But very oftentimes the American oak needs to be taken out of the whiskey solution before the French oak. The French is still imparting characters. The tannins are coming out more slowly, whereas the American oak is almost depleted and fully extracted at a faster rate. And so it's getting to know the whiskey, the interaction of the whiskeys and the wood, and again, at different proofs. Mm-hmm. There was a time some years ago when I liked to do all of my oak extractions at high proof. We've changed that. We now bring the whiskey pretty close to bottle strength, make sure the whiskey base is correct, and mm-hmm. then begin the oak extractions and taste them very regularly. And when they're at the right level, we remove it. Each tote is going to extract differently, even if it's the same whiskey and the same types of staves. We know that that temperature is a factor in the rate of extraction. So this kind of wood finishing, it's not willy-nilly. It takes a lot of oversight in order to achieve a balanced whiskey using different types of oak.
I'm just curious, and I know we're kind of bumping out of time. You have a few more minutes?
I've got plenty of time.
Cool. I don't even know why I made this a half episode. I was probably just made it a whole one, to be honest. The first thing I'm thinking of, and I'm sure you thought about it at some point in your process, is the Amrut Spectrum release, actually, I just did an interview with Raj Sabharwal. I'm not sure if this episode will come out before or after that one, about specifically about Amrut. But just as a reminder for listeners, so the Spectrum casks, they're on release 6 or 7 at this point. Each time they'll use 4 or 5 different woods. But they'll make a single cask out of those 4 or 5 different woods. So you have all those oaks. I'm assuming they're oaks. I think they're oaks. But let's say all the oaks impacting the whiskey at the same time. And the scientist in me is like, oh, that's way too many variables at once. I want to do more of your method of what you're describing. Have the single tote, single wood per batch, and then do it later. But on the other hand, the fusion releases were delicious. So, you know, there's something to it. So I'm curious if you have had the opportunity or would like the opportunity to try that kind of a style of maturation as well.
So I actually spoke with Raj last week, and because we're very interested, you know, we're very interested in whiskeys from all over the world, and have recently acquired some fantastic stocks of Indian single malt,
Oh.
which will be incorporated into some future releases that we couldn't be more excited about. And I see what Amrut is doing and other distilleries in India as well. The unique maturation conditions in particular, as well as other factors, are making India one of the more exciting places for whiskey, at least for my palate. So the scientist in me would go crazy kind of doing that, because ultimately what you're doing, in all whiskey makers at some point just kind of put their hands up and say, like, whiskey gods, like, I've put in the time, just treat me right on this project, like, help me out here, because we don't have control over so much. We wish we had control and we don't. So the Spectrum Cast, I've tried to think one or two of them. I also have been really impressed by it. But as a production process, it would make me go gray. I would be pulling my hair out, because you have no control. You have very little control over it. All you can do at that point is you can determine the barrel entry proof, which is going to affect the character of the spirit and the extraction rates of different things. In my experience, the lower the barrel entry proof, the sweeter the whiskey can become before the tannins take over. So,
which makes sense, as you were saying, because you're going to have more water and thus more wood sugar solubility, or you know what I mean? More wood sugars being
absolutely
dissolved and extracted from the wood, as opposed to the tannic side and the ethanol taking over. So,
But this comes back to what we were discussing earlier about whether the barrel itself is the best vessel for experimentation. Barrels have such variability, you know, barrel to barrel, even from the same cooperage, as we know, just from mm-hmm. companies with single barrel programs, that I've used barrels that have American oak staves and French oak heads, which was, mm-hmm. I think maybe even Compass Box helped sort of put that kind of style of whiskey forward.
Yeah, that became a little more, I wouldn't necessarily popular because it wasn't widespread, but there were a number using that mix, you know, because the heads, you don't get a lot of stuff from, just because it's not, but I don't know, that's a whole different tangent we can go on. Continue.
My experience with those, and at one point I had about 20 of those barrels going and I was tasting them. They were all extracting at different rates. And then I did a very similar thing with an equivalent number of barrels, but I think half of them were French oak, half of them were American oak. And I was like, okay, now we can remove the whiskey from each barrel when it's ready. We know exactly what kind of component it's going to be within the larger blend. So yeah, the Amrut Spectrum, I bless them for doing it. I find it number one, for better or for worse, because it cuts both ways, it's kind of unreproducible. So, you know, for better or for worse, this is mm-hmm. People love limited edition to have one of 250 bottles or whatnot. That's fantastic. Sometimes when things are great, you want more of it. And that's very difficult to do in these sort of bespoke casks.
Absolutely. And the other part of production that we want to talk about specific to the Explorer and to other projects within Outsider Spirits portfolio is, I want to reiterate, because it's important for understanding how the wood's going to extract and interact with the whiskey, that you're not reconstructing casks to give that influence. You said you're putting the whiskey into either stainless steel or polyethylene IBCs to mix, mingle, blend, what and sit, whatever words you'd like to use there, and then inserting the staves into that. Is that correct?
So depending on the project, we use both of those methods. Okay. And at the end of the day, it's really about the quality of the spirit. Mm-hmm. And sometimes with some casks, I think future releases, I'll give an example. We have some beautiful Mizunara barrels. I mean, talk about having, like, yeah. it's Mizunara is such a phenomenal input, component, ingredient in whiskey. The depth of character that it provides is just noticeable. Like, you just know it. Yeah. I wish that we could sometimes buy Mizunara staves so that we could build barrels of different sizes. It's just not really an option, or even use staves in totes, kind of like I was saying, because we have such better control over the process. You also have more surface area on a stave than you do in a barrel, right? If you think about the amount of liquid that's touching a barrel, maybe the whiskey goes in a quarter of an inch, right? And so the majority of the wood when you buy a barrel never sees whiskey. And all of that flavor is left there. You're still paying premium for the cooper and the space on a freight container. But you're really only using a quarter of the character of what you're paying for, because there's this priority over, you know, the priority of the vessel shape or whatnot. I've worked in situations before where we tried to, and not doing this with Mizunara at least yet, but where we were able to get barrels, like very special barrels. And we're so impressed with their extraction that we ended up kind of de-hooping them and essentially putting them in convection ovens to make the entire stave all the way around 360 degrees, the equivalent of that small part that was touching the whiskey originally. And now you can make several times that amount of whiskey using the same quality input. And you already trust the input because you had a great experience with the first extraction.
Right. And it reminds me of an article. I keep meaning to write this article and just, I don't know. I never sit down to actually do it, but it goes to your point, which is the fallacy of the red line. If you go to, I would safely say most distilleries in the US, and they show you as part of the production, they show you a stave and they're like, you see this line going across, this reddish brownish line, it's darker than the rest of the wood. That's where the liquid soaks into. And I took that at face value for a long time because I figure, okay, you're going through the char level, like maybe it's 6 to 10 years old. Maybe it does soak that far into the wood. And, you know, we've all seen like a liquid stain. It can, has a capillary action where it can just go a little farther than the liquid itself. But at the same time, as soon as I started talking to coopers about that, they're like, no, this is not where the liquid goes to. It's, that's where the joiners are between the staves, and the liquid is just going farther in because there's space in between the staves. While the cask itself may be, you know, liquid tight, you can have spaces within that sphere or the, you know, barrel shape where more liquid gets in. That's what's giving those lines. And that's why you'll see, if you look at a stave, you'll have that quote unquote soak line on one side and not on the other. And if it was soaking through uniformly, it would be on both sides. So they only show you the one side that has the soak line. So that goes back to your point of, you want to get all of that wood. You want to get more surface area, more interaction. I almost think of it like a, you can also think of it like a loose leaf tea versus a tea bag, like a commercial tea bag. Loose leaf tea takes longer to brew and to steep because you're dealing with the whole leaf. It's got to go through it. And the commercial ones, like, you know, Lipton tea bag, the tea is ground up if you look in the bag. So it's already got so much more surface area. It's going to extract faster. That's why it's cheap to produce, cheap to give, and is very fast.
And consistent.
And consistent.
Over time, because you can make these enormous batches of it. Absolutely. And that's a, might have to borrow that at some point. That's
go for it.
Fantastic parallel.
Yeah.
And that's right. And another thing in terms of dealing with staves, a lot of folks have been experimenting with staves. It's a really amazing time in this industry where innovation is being celebrated, because I think it's improving, in many cases, improving either the quality of the whiskey or people's desire to try it. But another thing to note is that we are not, sometimes when you buy staves or barrels from a cooperage, they'll tell you you want to put it in for 3 months or 4 months or 3 weeks, and it will be fully extracted at that point. It's never been our desire to fully extract anything. We want to take it to the proper level. And sometimes that might be 15% of possible extraction. It's also important to realize that each one of these staves doesn't extract in a sort of linear fashion. Different characteristics are brought out almost sequentially. So if you take a sample at 1 week, 2 week, 3 week, 4 week, it's not just like getting more intense. It's going sort of up and down. 1 week, the sweetness might be more heightened. The next week, clearly something was happening with tannin. The following week, okay, the aroma has changed significantly. And there's these different extraction rates for different compounds inside of the wood. And we've been very fortunate to have the time and the resources to really experiment with different types of wood to understand not just what, if you plop staves and whiskey and wait for 8 weeks, this is what it tastes like, but to understand what happens at each step in the process, because sometimes there are woods, I promise you, that you don't want to put in for more than 4 weeks. Not that they get turgid or anything, but that sort of the height of the expression subjectively happens after 3.5 weeks. And once you know that, and you know the sequence of compounds that come out, and I'll give a shout out here to a former colleague of mine, Johnny Jeffrey, who wrote his master's thesis at Michigan State on the extraction. He used the same whiskey and he put it in a 5 gallon barrel, 10 gallon barrel, 15 gallon barrel, these barrels of different surface area to volume ratios. And he pulled samples weekly. This is a published paper. It's available online. John Jeffrey is a brilliant scientist and whiskey maker and fantastic human being. And what his research shows is that these different barrels, the extraction of various compounds happen at different times. Different compounds are more soluble and extract very quickly. And there's almost this sequence of extraction. At one point, we were playing with Amburana, and Amburana has so many compounds, and some of them are baking spices, and some of them are like butterscotch, and some of them are almost vegetal, like green pepper. And if you understand the sequence of extraction at a given proof point, so imagine you're extracting into 75% or 75 proof, below bottle strength, because sometimes you want to extract and blend that component back in to a larger batch, right? Like a concentrate. And sometimes you want to do that at a proof that's even below bottle strength, right? This is not necessarily a technique that large companies can do all the time, but it's pretty interesting. There are ways of pulling out the compounds you want and leaving other things behind, or free soaking in, call it a water solution, to pull out vegetal compounds so that they're not there when you put the wood into the whiskey and you're left just with baking spices and butterscotch, and you've left all the green pepper behind. Mm-hmm. As we learn more about wood and we learn about the compounds in each wood and how heat, like pyrolysis and toasting and roasting and charring, can free various compounds to become soluble in water and ethanol. We learn how to either minimize tannins in order to maximize sweetness, or how we can really remove or minimize some component, which might be perfectly fine. It might be caramel, but you're just not looking for it in a particular release. Sure. So I really look forward. I think in the next couple of years, we're going to learn a lot more about how to use wood rather than just put wood in whiskey. We're going to learn about how to toast it at a different level, how to remove characteristics that we're not necessarily looking for, and then using staves. And you can even recuper at that point. To create, you know, if someone were so inclined. And I think we're just at the beginning of this exploration of wood and whiskey. And that's what this line is really about, is thinking about whiskey and thinking about wood. Scientifically, certainly, in terms of what are we trying to extract, how are we using wood to complement the spirit or the blend of whiskeys, and then how can, again, we use these whiskeys to express stories of where the wood comes from, how else it's used, and maybe some of our sister industries. There are so many kind of Me Too whiskeys out there. Oh, this person's got an undifferentiated, whiskey with a toasted oak, it might be good. It might be fantastic. And if it's fantastic at the end of the day, that's what matters. But when you start looking at the broader world of wood and see how it's been used in perfume and incense and these other non-spirit, even non-wine related activities that are intended for sensory purposes, you can see that there's a huge vista that's kind of ready to be experimented with. And that's what we're here for.
I love it. And I think that's a great way to start to close out, is just reminding, this is just the first release in this second category from Outsider Spirits. The first being Journey, focusing on this cross-border blending. The second being the Oak. And I'm sorry, I've forgotten the third one that is coming out that you are working on. The third line.
We'll talk later about that one after the press release, but it's going to focus on agriculture. And
agriculture, thank you. Yes.
In our connection to the land, in whiskey's connection to the land.
And it's funny because all three of these together are looking at different lenses of what we would think of as terroir, sense of place, and how those places can interact with each other. But doing so in, I would argue, a semi-scientific way, that's not to detract from what you're doing. It's more just to say, like, actually, you know what? You are using GCMS sometimes. So, hell, screw the semi. It's in a scientific way.
NHPLC.
Look at this. NHPLC. Yeah.
So, factory. And we love using scientific tools to better understand our whiskey, for sure.
Right. So subtract the semi. It's in scientific ways to analyze these and to really understand what's going on. And while there is so much magic to the making of whiskey and spirits, the magic of the cask, the magic of the distillery, and the still itself, and the grain, and all these things that come into it, there's also scientific backing for ways to explore it that, to me at least, I don't think the science detracts from the magic at all. And I also think magic is kind of just unexplained. It's something science hasn't explained yet, in a way. But there are things that will remain magical about it. And I really like that. I look forward to seeing the next release from this, from exploring this a little bit more, seeing if I can find some other spirits or whiskeys that have been specifically aged from Troncay and see what kind of flavors pop up that are in combination, in comparison. I think ultimately that would be a lot of fun to do. So, yeah. So with that, Ari, welcome back on the podcast. You're always welcome to come on. Thank you so much. I'm sure we have a couple things to talk about offline, to other projects to talk about, to bring to the podcast, or to some writing. So I really look forward to it.
Excellent. It's wonderful to see you. I hope folks get a chance to try Whiskey Gypsy Explorer, the first of many. And and we'd love to hear from people who do get a chance to try it. It's available. You can go to whiskeygypsy.com, the website. It can be purchased from the website, and it's available in fine stores in Tennessee and Georgia and Florida, and other states are coming online really all the time. This is sort of the first mass market product that we're creating, and should be available in fine stores in many fine states very soon.
Awesome. And I'll throw that link in the show notes too, so people can click directly there from this episode. Ari, as always, hang on with me for just a second after recording. But as always, thank you for coming on. Thank you all for listening. This has been another special bonus episode of the Whiskey Ring podcast. And I will see you probably in a few days, because, these bonus episodes, I never know exactly when they're going to go out. So no, this one should go out in early April. And this product will be available as soon as this episode goes out. So cheers, everyone. And I'll see you shortly. Hey, folks, thanks for listening to another episode of the Whiskey Ring podcast. If you like what you hear, please go ahead and click that subscribe, follow, or like button. Leave a rating review on your podcast app of choice, and let me know what you want to hear. You can reach out to me through the podcast apps or email me at david@whiskeymywedding.com with any suggestions or ideas for new show guests. You can also support the podcast at patreon.com/whiskeyinmywedding. That's whiskey with an E, for as little as $1 a month. $5 a month gets you access to bonus content, including our soon-to-resume Under the Influencer series, and $25 a month means you join the BarrelShare Club. Each month, BarrelShare Club members get to try products sent to me for review, bottles from my own collection, and sometimes bottles that I just pick up because they're fun or interesting. Right now, only 5 spots remain in the BarrelShare Club, so grab your place today. Finally, please follow on Instagram. You can follow me at WhiskeyMyWeddingRing or at WhiskeyRingPodcast. You can follow me on Twitter at WhiskeyRing. You can follow on Facebook at WhiskeyMyWeddingRing or join the Facebook group, the Whiskey Ringers group. And I hope to see you there. Cheers. Thank you for the support and see you next time.